From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Every day, thousands of new sites appear on the part of the internet known as the World Wide Web. One of the most popular directories for finding your way around the web is called Yahoo. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Jerry Yang, who co-founded Yahoo a year and a half ago when he was a graduate student at Stanford. Also today, the voices of a new generation of feminists. We talk with Rebecca Walker, who has edited a new anthology subtitled Telling the Truth and Changing the Face of Feminism. Her mother is writer Alice Walker. Her godmother is Gloria Steinem. Maureen Corrigan has a review of the novel that won this year's prestigious Booker Prize in England. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the language of publicity and self-promotion. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta and other administration officials are meeting with congressional negotiators this afternoon in an attempt to find areas of compromise to break the budget impasse. The negotiators are said to be reviewing proposals from conservative House Democrats, Senate Democrats, and a bipartisan group of centrist senators. Tomorrow, the president and top congressional leaders will meet at the White House to be briefed on the outcome of today's sessions. Even if progress is made, however, House Majority Leader Dick Armey says GOP congressmen will not approve a stopgap spending bill to get the government running again before a complete budget agreement has been reached. UPI's Bill Clough reports some House Republicans delivered a symbolic Christmas gift for the president today.
All is fair in war and politics, so House Republicans now have drafted Santa as an ally in their battle with the White House over the budget. Ohio Representative John Boehner played the role of Santa.
We've been making a list, and we've been checking it twice, and we think that the president deserves only one thing for this Christmas, because he's not done his work. And that's a little coal that we put in the president's box this year.
Not coal, but charcoal. But on Capitol Hill, where metaphor is the coin of the realm, one might question the use of sending charcoal to the White House. It might be construed as sending coals to Newcastle. Bill Clough, Capitol Hill.
A business student, a young girl, and a doctor are among the four survivors of the crash of an American Airlines jetliner in Colombia last night. 160 other people aboard the Boeing 757 are thought to have died. The plane was en route from Miami to Cali, Colombia. The jet went down in the Andes just 4 minutes before its scheduled landing. Investigators still aren't sure of the cause of the crash, which is the first ever for a Boeing 757. Palestinians celebrated today as Israel handed over the city of Bethlehem after 28 years of occupation. The BBC's Lise Doucette has more.
Palestinian police arrived to take charge, welcomed by thousands of cheering Palestinians, firing rifles in the air and setting off fireworks. Church bells pealed. Every car, horns blaring, carried Palestinian flags. Streamers of flags and pictures of Yasser Arafat crisscrossed the streets of Bethlehem, while tiny fairy lights twinkled and pint-sized Santa Clauses rang golden bells in this town where Jesus was born. This year, Palestinians of all faiths are celebrating his birth and the start of self-rule in the town. No sooner had Israeli troops left, Palestinians tore down the hated symbols of occupation. The barbed wire fences and gates, which had long ringed a square, which saw clashes and violence with occupation forces.
The BBC's Lise Doucette in Bethlehem. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 23 points at 5,081 in heavy trading. In the over-the-counter market, the Nasdaq Composite is up 11. This is NPR News. The Army has delayed the scheduled date for the main contingent of U.S. peacekeeping troops to enter Bosnia. The new date is December 30th. A Pentagon official attributed the delay to bad weather that has hampered construction activity and to rail travel constraints imposed by authorities in Austria and Hungary. Most of the 20,000 U.S. troops slated to take part in the peacekeeping operation will enter Bosnia over a floating bridge to be built at the Bosnian-Croatian border. Chechen rebels have pulled out of the region's second-largest town after a week-long battle with Russian troops that reportedly left over 100 people dead. The rebels were trying to stop Chechnya's Moscow-based government from bringing election ballots into the town. Sharing gifts with those less fortunate has become as much a tradition as Christmas shopping for many. In Syracuse, several social service agencies have gotten together to provide a bit of Christmas cheer. From member station WAER, Jennifer Staten reports.
The Syracuse Volunteer Center handed out more than 20,000 dolls, games, and other toys even some stocking stuffers. At the same time, the local Salvation Army had baskets of food, including a Christmas turkey, for poor families that had registered in advance. 10-year-old Rodnisha Golden was among the more than 1,000 volunteers at the city's convention center.
It feels good to help people that I can't help myself, and to give people help and give a hand.
Some 2,000 families took part in the annual Christmas cheer. Volunteer center officials say that's more than in years past, and they say the families have more children this time around, which puts a little more pressure on the holiday goodwill of those who donated the goods. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Staten in Syracuse.
For the first time in its history, Mount Rushmore has had to close. The national park in South Dakota has fallen victim to the partial government shutdown. During the last government shutdown, visitors could still stroll the grounds. This time, they're closed, but the mount will remain lighted. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Newsweek has called 1995 the year of the Internet, the worldwide network of computers that was embraced this year as the medium that will change the way we communicate, shop, and publish. Much of this explosive growth has taken place on the part of the Internet called the World Wide Web, millions of interlinked websites that can feature text, image, sound, and interactivity. This growth presented a new problem. How do you find what you need on the web? An estimated 800,000 people a day use an online internet directory called Yahoo. My guest, Jerry Yang, along with David Filo, created Yahoo a year and a half ago when they were graduate students at Stanford University. Yahoo started as a hobby, but it's now a thriving business. I asked Jerry Yang how many websites they add each week to the Yahoo directory.
We add about probably around 5,000 to 6,000 new sites every week into Yahoo. We also get more than that submitted to us because of people, when they build a website, they want to make sure it gets known by other people, and Yahoo is often a very great vehicle for doing that. And we try to review everything that comes in, and we're trying really hard to keep up with the demand. We can't hire fast enough to deal with the growth. We were at about 1,000 entries a day being submitted into Yahoo about 2 months ago. Now we're up to about 3,000 entries a day being submitted. So it's really just an operational task to even keep up with the submissions. But we hope to do that in the next couple of weeks by hiring more people and getting the system set up so we can handle more people submitting entries into Yahoo.
Now, one of the things that I think has made Yahoo so successful is that, you know, in addition to offering a directory to websites, you also have editorial judgments on there. You know, you have cool sites and news sites that you've chosen for your users. What are some of your favorites of the current cool sites? And what does a site need to do to be in there?
Cool. Yeah, I think one of the best parts of our jobs at Yahoo is because we are always exposed to often what's new, the newest and the coolest, and we have the opportunity to review them. And it's often a very hard task to formulate opinions about what's cool and what's not cool. In fact, we have lots of debate at Yahoo every day. The sites lately that are really cool for me are ones, and it always has been, the ones that push the internet and the web as a medium. It really isn't about kind of shoveling some existing content onto the web into a brochure kind of format, but rather using the web as a medium, and that's kind of what we look for. And lately, there has been a lot of, for example, a lot of Christmas sites, and a lot of people have done really interesting applications or web pages that portray either shopping or travel or Christmas kind of spirit things. There's a site about Christmas lyrics that is really well done. So making the web as part of as efficient as possible for not only entertainment type of stuff, but also making it part of your daily routine for productivity, looking at movies, buying movie tickets. All these things are becoming the next generation, making part of a daily routine.
Now, are there pages that you don't even bother to categorize that just aren't
worth
it?
There are some. There are some, and we have to remind ourselves that Yahoo started to be very inclusive and try to be very open-minded about what kind of contents are out there. There are some stuff that if they don't satisfy the minimum requirement, and in our sense, minimum is pretty minimum, almost none of it is editorially oriented. sites that have to have what we call a significant amount of content. So if it's just two lines of text that says, hi, hello, world, usually will not get categorized. But by and large, we do categorize just about everything. Certainly, we don't limit things based on opinion and belief, although things that are illegal, we try to be very cautious of and not get into problems. So how to make a bomb or things like that, we try not to get into. And it's a tough call sometimes just because we're also very into the freedom of expression, the freedom of ideas, but we also have to have a conscience when doing that.
What about pornography?
The conventional way we dealt with it is we try to list as much as possible, there's a lot of commercial entities that are, whether they're legal or not illegal, most of them are legal, like Penthouse and Playboy. They do have a listing in Yahoo. There are a lot of them that are not so legal, meaning that they're just students who put up pictures that they find or whatever. Those we tend not to include. And what happens is when we do include them in the past, a long time ago, people would, because Yahoo is so popular, people would go there so fast and in such great numbers, that site would go down almost, immediately. And we would have to remove it. And so there's a very interesting market mechanism here where sites that can't support itself usually go away, and whether that's pornography or whatever, if pornography just happens to be one of those that can draw enough numbers to create this market mechanism.
When you say that some of the pornography sites became so popular so quickly, the sites went down, what does that mean?
I'm sorry. Usually pornography sites are very graphic intensive, and what happens is when you have graphic intensive sites, you have very large amount of information that are being transferred to transfer the graphics down to your computer so you can view them. When a lot of people starts doing that, it clogs up literally like a highway congestion type of scenario where too many people are trying to get too much information through too thin of a pipe. And that what happens to the computer is either it can't handle that request anymore, it kind of slows down to a crawl, in which case usually that computer is residing on some university and the university shuts it down. So it's basically overloading the system, and often that computer is shared by thousands of other people as their student computer or their dormitory computer. So it's a bad citizen thing to try to get too much traffic on your website, especially if for some reason like the pornography.
Jerry, how did you start doing Yahoo? How did the idea first come to be?
Well, the online version of it, we were both graduate, David Filo and myself were graduate students at Stanford in 1993. Well, we've been there for about 5 years. The one day the internet kind of came up on us like everybody else, and it was intrigued us in a way that we haven't been really intrigued by anything else in the past. And you have to realize being in a PhD student, you find ways to distract yourself as often and as long as you can. And the internet was probably the perfect candidate for total distraction for us, because we can spend hours on it and do a lot of other work and never get back to our thesis. So it turned out to be at first a very much of a hobby where we felt that David was categorizing things and finding all kinds of interesting things that was never quite as good as finding interesting things as he was. And so I would always ask him, hey, where was that thing that you found yesterday? And he got sick of me asking, so he put all his stuff in the database. And he said, well, in case you ever find anything interesting, why don't you also stick it in here? And so it was kind of a, at first it was a contest of sorts where we were trying to see if we can outdo each other. And he developed a search mechanism to search across it.
He wrote software to search?
Right. He's the brains behind all this. He wrote software to develop the hierarchy, the directory, and the search engine. And it's, a good piece of work. It's not truly high tech or anything. It's just something that works, and it's something that we can and he had to refine it over time as we got more traffic and more people using it. But it really started out as a hobby, and it really started out as something that we both enjoyed contributing to, because we feel like we were benefiting from it as a user, and we really had the user in mind when we started it.
And this was when?
This was, April of 1994-ish.
not
very long ago. Seems like a long time ago.
What was the web like then? What were you using it for?
Well, we were both in the computer science community, and a lot of times what we were using it for is for technical information and finding out computer or computer industry-related information on the Internet. And that was basically what it was for. Then I think there were also some amount of entertainment stuff that people started putting on the web. But those are usually came from, you know, the computer scientists and the techie community. So, you know, stuff like UFOs and really kind of geek humor type of stuff. But it was, then it quickly outgrew that in the late 1994. I think people really realized the potential of it and started putting more consumer entertainment and also more broad-based general information type of information on the Internet.
Jerry Yang is my guest, co-founder of Yahoo, which is an online directory to the World Wide Web and one of the most frequently visited sites on the web. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jerry Yang, co-founder of Yahoo, which is an online directory to the World Wide Web. Now, there's an actual book directory to Yahoo also, which is called Yahoo Unplugged. So you started off with a little directory that you and your partner could use to get around on the web. How did you start getting your directory out to other people?
Well, it was really strange. I think a lot of it had to do with timing, because we probably introduced something that was usable and was well-maintained, and somebody actually put effort in, which was really all we needed at the time. We put it on the web, and you know, there was no notion of advertising or promotion back then. And we basically, it was a lot of word of mouth, and people kind of knew about it through various channels, usually most of them very grassroots.
So, you know, early on this was a hobby. Did it get to the point where it was hard to keep up with everything new that was happening on the web that you wanted to put in your directory?
Yeah, I think by the summer of 1994, we realized that we were getting to something that we probably were going to regret doing. The problem was that it was quickly dominating our day, and we would spend probably, 8 hours not only adding to the database. We also had to improve it. We had to increase the capabilities. We had to figure out ways in which to handle more traffic. So by the end of the summer, early fall of 1994, we were pretty much faced with the question of how we're going to keep this thing going. And that was the time we realized that if we decided to do this more permanent basis, it was going to really take us, it was already dragging us by, you know, by the hair, kicking and screaming, and it's really going to take off, and we were going to not have too much control over it. It's going to take us where it wants to go. So I think the critical juncture was late summer of last year, when we kind of went over the critical mass, and there was so much people using it and wanting to be listed and demanding more capabilities, those kinds of things that were driving us. No longer being a hobby, it was kind of a job.
Well, once you realize it's no longer a hobby, it's kind of a job, then you probably figured, well, if it's a job, you better find a way to make some money doing it.
Yeah, I think it sounds kind of strange now, but even back then, we never thought about making money, because you have to realize there was really no commercial model back then. Even, nobody was making money on the Internet back then. So we never thought about making money off of it. We did think about it as very much as a... It was as close as to us having, you know, being men, having children as possible, because here we are, we had this thing, and it was very well accepted by the community, and it was really hard to let it go. It was really hard to say, well, we got to go finish our thesis and let's just put Yahoo off for a while, or give it away, or do something with it other than running it ourselves. So we we wanted to just find a home for it. It was kind of like finding a foster home for it. It was really kind of weird. We wanted to just put it somewhere we would be able to work on it part-time. We needed to get off Stanford because of the resources it was consuming. And we were just going to go find a way. We were probably going to have somebody sponsor it, maybe put their company logo on it or something. But, you know, it's very kind of a pure sense of commercialism. It wasn't really for money. It was really just to make sure that we can sustain Yahoo as an entity outside of Stanford.
So what route did you decide to take to keep Yahoo alive and to enable you to continue working on it?
Well, we little do we know the wind of commercialism was already blowing, and certainly around the Silicon Valley. The discussions we had in the beginning were very just friends who had, you know, access to websites and access to the internet, and we're asking them if they would host it for us. But as soon as people knew that Yahoo was going off of Stanford, a lot of people started thinking about commercial possibilities. What we ended up doing through the winter of 94 was talking to various people, and we met all kinds of people, including other startups, venture capitalists, and other people who thought that they could use the directory for one reason or another. And there were so many choices for us that it was really one of the harder decisions to make. So what we ended up doing was to delay our decision by taking the most neutral way possible, which was actually venture capital money, because that ensured us to do what we wanted to do, more creativity, and not having to decide on either a commercial entity to belong with or working with someone as you know who owned Yahoo.
Where are you now? Go ahead.
So the route that we did was, in February we moved our servers to Netscape, who their founder Mark Andreessen was kind enough to offer us a space to host our service for a while until we figured out what we wanted to do. And at the same time, we also took some money from a venture capitalist, Sequoia Capital, here in the Silicon Valley. And we really didn't know how to make it of it as a business, but heck, we figured it wasn't going to be any worse than staying at Stanford, so we gave it a shot.
I wonder, you know, you're, what, in your late 20s, right?
Right, exact age is not being disclosed at this point.
Oh, yeah, real sensitive about that.
Getting older.
Well, how old are you?
I'm 27.
27, okay. So you're 27, you've been at this for a couple of years, and it happens to have been the couple of years when the net just absolutely exploded. So you're really an extraordinary success story now. I mean, you're standing right in the middle of the place that lightning is striking every day, right? And I wonder what that feels like for you. I mean, the web is like the big story of the year, and you're right in the middle of it.
Yeah, I think somebody wrote about us first of all, somebody called us dropouts, but, you know, wrote basically, we are, I guess, in a sense.
Well, from your doctoral dissertation, I mean, yeah, not exactly dropping out of high school. Go ahead.
Close enough. The somebody wrote that, you know, these guys set up a lemon stand in middle of a hayfield, and somebody else happened to decide to build skyscrapers around them, and it does feel something like that. I think there are so much advantages of being in the right place in the right time, and part of I look back on 1995, and it's really one of those years where if I had planned it, if I had the vision, if I had everything, I still couldn't have done as well as we did. And so, you know, a lot of it has to do with just being in the right place and right time. Everybody asks me, you know, what is Yahoo planning to do? And I think what we've done well and we're going to have to continue to do is reacting to this massively complicated system of information, communities, and social interaction. And that changes all the time, and you can't predict it, nor can you try to control it and harness it. So our goal is really to be able to adapt to the environment and being part of a system rather than trying to control it and become dominant. And for us, we become very much humbled by the process more than anything else, because for us it's bewildering every day what people either use Yahoo to do or can do without Yahoo. And one of the things that Yahoo stands for, internally at least, and it's really reminding us of how much humility we ought to have, especially on the internet, even though Yahoo is becoming well-known, is you always have other options, which spells Yahoo if you took the first letter of each word. And that's what we're reminded of, because our consumers, our users have the power, and the internet allows them to be consumers of information that have the ultimate choice. And we have to keep designing our service so that people prefer us and not because they have to, because they don't have to use us.
When you look ahead, what do you see as being the biggest changes on the internet that you're going to have to react to?
I think that I think there are a couple of fronts. I think that internet, we'll see the second wave of technology coming in 1996 with security, with multimedia delivery, with more and better tools. And there's certainly a lot of talk about battles forming with the giants like Netscape and Microsoft. And we don't know how that's going to really end up, especially for content providers like Yahoo and everybody else, really, deciding on how to publish information through what channel is going to be a big challenge. Lastly, I think the change is really going to be how easy can the internet be for the average user. I was trying to show my mother how to get on the internet last week, and it took me 4 hours to get on the internet, and it was just a very, very trying experience, to say the least. So, you know, it's still a ways away from a click and you're on the net kind of a environment, even though it's getting better every day. But overall, I think it's going to be another tremendous year for the internet, because it's got so much potential that hasn't been explored yet.
I have one last question for you. So can your mother access the internet now? Does she know how?
Well, I'll take 2 seconds to reply to that. Last week here, we had a tremendous storm in the Bay Area. It was, you know, hurricane-force winds, and it was probably the worst in decades. And I called her, trying to check up on her, and the phone was busy all night. And then I was really worried. So the next night, I called her, and I said, "Mom, what the hell is going on? Is the house okay?" And she goes, "Yeah, I was surfing on the internet." So I guess in a storm, she was still able to explore the world through the web. So I was very happy to hear that. She did it without me, so it's good.
That's good. Okay. Jerry Yang, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jerry Yang co-founded Yahoo, an online directory to the World Wide Web. There's also a new Yahoo book called Yahoo Unplugged. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Maybe publicists have done wonders to enhance the images of corporations and political parties, but when they tried to work their magic on behalf of Stanford University recently, the press and the faculty had a field day with them. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg confesses, though, that he has a new sympathy for the maligned publicists, which he developed after he read a childhood classic.
It wasn't a speech code exactly, more like a bit of usage advice. The idea was to get the Stanford administration and faculty to speak with one voice in promoting the university and setting it apart from its rivals. To this end, Terry Shepard, the university's director of communications, issued a strategic plan that included a single list of adjectives for people to use when they talked about the place. There were six of them in all: challenging, incomparable, boundless, stunning, Western, and vibrant. Shepard explained the list by saying, if we all use the same terms, Stanford would come to mean the same things to people. It all seems fair enough to me. I don't know that Stanford's any more challenging or incomparable than Yale or Chicago, but it's for sure more Western. And it's certainly more vibrant than those other schools, which are sitting 1,000 miles from the nearest major fault line. According to University President Gerhard Casper, the idea for the list was originally proposed by some Stanford trustees who come from the business world. It's an approach that's worked very nicely for corporations, and a few years ago, Newt Gingrich showed how effective it can be as a political strategy when he had GOPAC issue a list of 64 adjectives for Republican candidates to memorize and use to describe themselves and their opponents. But when the list was leaked to the press, the Stanford faculty proved to be deficient in the team spirit that it takes to put this approach over the top. Academics tend to have the sense that they ought to be allowed to make up their own words. There was a heated meeting of the faculty senate, and other adjectives began to fill the air, words like anti-intellectual, vapid, insulting. The president rapidly decided to scrap the plan. I can understand the faculty point of view, but I have to say I feel a certain sympathy for the communications people, too. It's a profession that gets no respect, which is probably why they keep changing the job title every 10 years or so to spruce up their image. They were press agents, then they were public relations people, now they're in communications. But people keep heaping abuse on them. But you have to give them at least this: there's nobody else who has such a devotion to the powers of language. The point came home to me the other night when my daughter and I were reading Charlotte's Web. It's a book that everybody loves, of course, but it must have had a special place in the hearts of the communications folks. I mean, here's this creepy little creature feeding on flies in a corner of the barn who's trying to save a pig from slaughter. So she gets a rat to pick some clippings out of the garbage, and then she spins this gossamer of words out of her bottom, and all of a sudden, everybody's looking at the pigsty with new eyes. What a wonderful fable of the power of a publicist to transform our perceptions of the world. So maybe we could give the people in the Stanford Communications Office the benefit of the doubt on that list of adjectives, particularly when the object of their attentions is something every bit as worthy as Wilbur was. Stanford University, vibrant, stunning, some pig.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. For many women, becoming a feminist has meant breaking with values they grew up with. Rebecca Walker grew up with feminist values. Her mother is writer Alice Walker, best known for her novel The Color Purple. Her godmother is Gloria Steinem. Walker, who is now in her mid-20s, says her generation's brand of feminism is different from her mother's. Walker has edited a new anthology of essays by young writers called To Be Real, Telling the Truth and Changing the Face of Feminism. Walker is also co-founder of Third Wave, a national organization of young women activists. In her introduction to her new anthology, Rebecca Walker writes about why she felt compelled to challenge some of the feminist assumptions she was brought up with.
A year before I started this book, my life was like a feminist ghetto. Every decision I made, person I spent time with, word I uttered, had to measure up to an image I had in my mind of what was morally and politically right, according to my vision of female empowerment. Everything had a gendered explanation, and what didn't fit into my concept of feminist was bad, patriarchal, and problematic. I couldn't stay intimate with a male friend who called someone a bitch derogatorily and revealed an undecolonized mind. I couldn't live with a partner because I would never be able to maintain my independence and artistic strength as a woman. I couldn't utter thoughts of dislike or jealousy for another woman because that would mean I was horribly unfeminist and so horribly bad. My existence was an ongoing state of saying no to many elements of the universe and picking and choosing to allow only what I thought should belong. The parts of myself that didn't fit into my ideal were hidden down deep, and when I faced them for fleeting moments, they made me feel insecure and confused about my values and identity. curiosity about pornography, attraction to a stable domestic partnership, a desire to start a business and pursue traditional individual power, interest in the world of SM, a love for people who challenged and sometimes flatly opposed my feminist beliefs. These feelings in themselves were not terribly terrible, and I think that for most who consider them, they seem terribly trivial. But for me, and my sense of how to make feminist revolution, they represented contradictions that I had no idea how to reconcile.
Now, was there a turning point in your life where you decided that rather than trying to negate those parts of your life that contradicted what you thought you were supposed to believe in, that you'd kind of admit them into your life and just deal with the contradictions or change what you believed?
Yes. I mean, that has been the journey of making this book.
This book was the turning point?
The beginning of this book, yeah. I mean, I think the culmination of the process of making this book has been a real feeling of self-acceptance, that an understanding that I think what's most critical, or one of the most critical aspects of feeling empowered as an individual, as a woman, is to be self-accepting, to understand that our lives are complex and contradictory often, and that the journey shouldn't be about, you know, beating oneself up because one isn't perfect, but about really struggling to explore and understand what those complications or contradictions are really about.
Issa Davis has a piece in your collection in which she tries to understand why it is she likes hip-hop so much, even when the rap is sexist.
Yes.
Do you think it's a typical problem a lot of women have now?
I do. I mean, I think it's something that we all struggle with. You know, how do we condone or how do we participate in something whose politics aren't perfect, whose politics are problematic to us on some level? How do we reconcile something that we may also cringe when we hear, even though we're attracted to it? So her piece is called Hip Hop and the what is it called? Sexism. What is it? Sexism and the Art of Feminist Hip Hop Maintenance. And it's sort of the cornerstone of the piece is her finding herself at the record store trying to decide between Snoop Doggy Dogg's Doggy Style and Queen Latifah's Black Rain, and which one should she buy with her last $15. And then she really sort of struggles with her feeling of not feeling oppressed or in any way kind of
degraded by
Snoop Doggy Dogg's misogyny, and how she feels that she wants to, instead of sort of critiquing him and shutting him out of her life and not listening to this hip hop culture with which she grew up, how can she, instead of shutting it out and denying herself this exploration, how can she dialogue with these artists, and how can she find her own identity as separate from the identity that's being portrayed of women in the music?
Has your experience been that a lot of women who are your friends of your age don't identify with the word feminism or the thoughts behind the word?
Yeah. I mean, I've one of the reasons that I did this book is because after I started Third Wave and did this huge voter registration drive and started to go around to college campuses and talking to women's groups about feminism and about the need for young people to get more involved in politics, I heard again and again from young people that the rhetoric or the language of feminism, the label itself, this whole sort of sensibility around movement politics just didn't really seem organic to the young people's lives I was talking to. And so part of why I did this book was to try to explore what that was about. What was this alienation about? Why didn't the young people want to call themselves feminist?
Well, why do you think?
Well, I think for a lot of reasons. I think they think that it means having to side with one group against another group. I think that there's so much baggage around feminism as well that's come from the media. I think there have been so many horrible stereotypes about feminists, you know, and everyone sort of believes them. I talk to people and they say, well, you know, you have to be angry, you can't shave your legs. You know, there are all these restrictions that get put on your life. And also people pigeonhole you. When you say that you're a feminist, you get put into a little box and you're more easily dismissed. And I think young people are sensitive to that, and we don't want to be dismissed, and we don't want to be labeled.
Now, your mother is Alice Walker, uh-huh, the feminist writer. Your godmother is Gloria Steinem. No explanation needed there. Are there any things that your mother or Gloria Steinem told you about their lives and the conditions that they faced as girls or young women that seemed really far away from your world?
Definitely. I mean, you know, my mother talks about, you know, when she, one of her jobs that she had before she started writing, she might have been just out of college or she might have been in college. I remember her telling me about, you know, working at someone's office. I think it might have been a political figure, someone. And I remember her telling me about him chasing her around the desk, you know, literally trying to touch her, chasing her around this desk. And, you know, her just feeling of, you know, total indignation and anger, but having no real place to challenge him from, no platform, no sense of her right to really, you know, stop this man, and also her sense of really needing this job. And, you know, that, you know, is just very difficult for me to imagine. You know, I mean, if a guy did that to me, I would just sort of instantly, you know, say stop. I mean, you know, and feel completely comfortable saying that, and feel that I had the real support of a whole community of the law of you know. I think Gloria has talked a lot about, you know, when she was growing up, the assumption that she would marry. You know, the assumption that, you know, at a certain age she would marry, and so. I remember, I think for her it was right after college. She was actually engaged to be married, and it was so stressful for her because she didn't really want to marry this guy, but she felt so obligated and so compelled that it was really, you know, an immense struggle for her to say no to him and break it off and to go on about her life. And I just don't, you know, I don't feel that sense of you know, that I'm supposed to marry, that's, you know, kind of, and that I could in any way be obligated to someone who I wasn't completely, totally, fantastically in love with. I just don't have that.
Rebecca Walker is my guest. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Rebecca Walker is my guest. She's edited a new anthology of young feminist writers called To Be Real. You've written earlier, Rebecca, that you were afraid that the love of the women in your life was conditional. Your mother, Alice Walker's love, your godmother, Gloria Steinem, that they wouldn't love you if you expressed a different point of view.
Mm-hmm.
What gave you that feeling?
I think that within groups that are very ideologically based, you know, you're constantly, at least in my family, we were constantly talking about, you know, what was right and what was good in terms of feminism and the movement and women as a whole, and what was wrong, so that every interaction became a kind of, it was weighed and measured and sought to be understood through this understanding of what was good for the world. And, you know, I participate, I mean, many of our conversations in the family were those kinds of conversations. And so, you know, constantly growing up in that kind of environment, you start to really feel that, wow, you know, what if one of the things that I did didn't fit into the equation right, you know, and you know, I think it's not so unusual, really, for people to have that kind of struggle, either with family members or friends. I mean, it's the struggle of wanting to be like the people that you love, wanting to share a kind of outlook and ideology, but also really needing to honor and respect your own individuality.
Your mother is African-American, your father is white, your parents divorced when you were young.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you identify more as African-American or biracial, if that's changed at different times of your life. And I ask you this because I think so much, I mean,
mm-hmm.
identity is so much a part of the kind of essay that you've included in your
mm-hmm.
anthology.
Mm-hmm. I think as I grew up, as I first sort of came into my political consciousness, I was very much African-American identified. And then I felt often that in order to be African-American identified, I had to really leave out, you know, my father and my father's family and the whiteness that is a part of my life. And as I got more and more uncomfortable sort of checking half of myself at the door, I really started to challenge the African-American community that I was within by saying, well, you know, don't say that about white people. I'm half white. Or, you know, please don't generalize that, you know, I love some white people dearly and they're not all that way. Or, and of course, as when I was in the white communities, I would always be thought of as African-American. So it was never that I was really privy to white racism or could really pass as white. But I definitely was always on guard with white people around their own racism. So, you know, going back and forth and trying to make each side understand the complexity of the other side really gave me a perspective on the world that I think I take with me as a biracial person, trying to create a world in which people are more willing to see each other as individuals rather than as part of a group or category that have been so either maligned or generally judged.
Was your father pleased that his half of your identity was becoming more a part of the picture?
Sure. I think it was important for our relationship that you know, we could, you know, and we still have tough times, you know, discussing race. I mean, my father is, you know, he's sometimes, you know, close to being a hardcore Zionist, you know, and we have very different opinions about a lot of different things, and we still struggle around this issue of race. But I think, you know, being able to be in dialogue with him and to try to understand where he's coming from and to try to make him see where I'm coming from as a person of color who's had a very different experience based on the color of my skin than he has had, you know, has been very good for our relationship. It's made it much more real.
Do people have certain expectations of you because you're the daughter of a famous writer and feminist?
You know, it's hard to tell. You know, I think that many do. I think I have a lot of expectations for myself, and those might have been the most difficult, you know, feeling that you have to, you know, measure up in some way. You know, those are awfully big shoes to fill. I think I resisted writing for most of my life because I just said to myself, how could I ever be as good a writer as my mom? It's just impossible. So I, you know, and I think that people, you know, before the book really did sort of see me as the sort of natural extension that, you know, much of what I was going to say was going to be the same as what she had said or, you know, in content and ideology. And in many ways, this book has been about really showing and exploring, you know, how I am different and how I'm not going to sound the same and how that's appropriate and wonderful. But I found in my struggle with this issue of expectations that often the kind of internal pressure is greater than that, all that pressure that people are projecting onto you, that you can't quite, you know, you don't really know if it's real or you're imagining it.
You know, I think it's interesting for the essays in the book, you really wanted people to say things that really challenged their own beliefs, challenged their mm-hmm. own beliefs about feminism, those contradictions that mm-hmm. they had to live with between what they felt and what they believed they should feel, or, mm-hmm. you know, and so on. And your essay, though, is not nearly as personal as what you demanded of other people.
That's why I'm the anthologist and editor. Well, I think that, you know, I worked so hard to cultivate these essays. I mean, all of these essays, to some degree, are me. You know, they're about mm-hmm. A struggle that I really relate to, or that I've, you know, had to grapple with. You know, I feel that I'm very much as exposed in putting all these things out there, in commissioning them and working with the writers so closely and really sharing these ideas with the world. I didn't feel that my introduction had to be as specific in a way, because I felt that the whole book spoke for me.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if it's harder for you to be as personal, because if you write about your family, we're going to know who some of them are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's making the people in your life public in a way that's different because they're already public people. They're already known.
Yeah, known definitely. Figures. And also, I mean, you know, as a public person or the child of a public person, you really have to, I think, negotiate the boundary of private and public so carefully.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not interested in sort of exposing, you know, my whole family and the inner workings of my life in that kind of way, precisely as you said, because people do know who they are and because we have a real family life that I respect and that I cherish, and I don't really just want to kind of, you know, lay it out there in a way for people to consume. So, I think you're right.
Rebecca Walker edited the new anthology, To Be Real, Telling the Truth and Changing the Face of Feminism. Coming up, a review of the novel that won this year's Booker Prize. This is Fresh Air. Pat Barker's novel, The Ghost Road, was scheduled to be published in the United States in August of 1996. But when The Ghost Road won Britain's prestigious Booker Prize, its publication date here was suddenly pushed up. Book critic Maureen Corrigan advises you not to delay in reading it.
I don't place much faith in reincarnation, but Pat Barker is making a believer out of me. How else to explain the eerie authenticity of The Ghost Road, her latest novel about World War I? There are small, startling images here about trench life amidst frozen corpses and walls spiked with bone fragments that only Isaac Rosenberg or Eric Maria Remarque could have captured. There are the death rattles of gassed soldiers that only Wilfred Owen or Vera Brittain could have recorded. And it's almost impossible for a contemporary writer to recreate just the right tone of baffled fury that inflects the literature of the World War I generation. We're all too familiar, at least theoretically, with what total warfare can do. If Pat Barker didn't live through World War I in a previous life, she somehow managed, nonetheless, to make the war live again in this novel. Actually, Barker has pulled off this literary feat of waking the dead before. The Ghost Road is the last volume in an extraordinary trilogy about World War I that began with Barker's 1992 novel, Regeneration, and continued through The Eye in the Door, published the following year. All three novels follow the fortunes of Dr. William Rivers, a real historical figure who specialized in the treatment of shell shock. Rivers treated the poets Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon, who play prominent parts in this trilogy. To their illustrious, addled company, Barker introduces her own fictional creation, Lieutenant Billy Pryor. A bisexual man who originally joined the army to escape his working-class background, Pryor dwells in a kind of societal no-man's land. The Ghost Road takes place in the summer of 1918 as the war is entering its final, frenzied stages. Both Pryor and Owen are desperate to get back to the front, to prove they've fully recovered from the breakdowns that sent them to Rivers Hospital. Rivers, meanwhile, still struggles with the ethics of his work, curing soldiers of shell shock, or as he puts it, taking away their sole defense against the unbearable, so that they can be sent back to their deaths. Falling prey himself to the Spanish influenza epidemic, Rivers hallucinates about his research work among headhunters in Melanesia and his childhood acquaintance with Lewis Carroll. In Rivers' fevered brain, Alice's morphine adventures in Wonderland become conflated with the grotesque bodily transformations caused by war. Part of the magical authority of the Ghost Road can be attributed to scrupulous homework on Barker's part. She describes the bright yellow complexions of munitions factory workers and the sound of lice eggs popping in the seams of soldiers' uniforms as their body heat warms them through. But it's the poetically precise voices of her chief narrators, Rivers and Pryor, that really command our attention. Here's Rivers, for example, describing his head nurse. She clawed her way out of the Gateshead slums and therefore felt obliged to believe in the corrosive effects on the human psyche of good food, good housing, and good education. There, in one elegant sentence, you have a complete portrait of a woman crippled by class resentment. If you know anything about Wilfred Owen's life, you know he did make it back to the front, only to be killed a week before the armistice. Like Owen, who many critics consider to be the greatest poet of World War I, Pat Barker stands in a distinguished line of artists who transcend human barbarism with the resonant consolation of their own sympathetic imaginations.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Ghost Road by Pat Barker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Kathy Wolf, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of A Christmas Memory by Truman Capote, and the modern library edition of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.